Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today. Gardening is a hobby that lasts a lifetime. And today we're going to be taking a look at what you can do to get kids interested in gardening. Mark Dwyer back with us. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He's a speaker, educator, author, degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. Great to have him back with us. So what gardening questions or comments do you have? I hope you'll join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Mark Dwyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Pleasure to be on.
I grew up on a farm, and my mother had a huge garden, and she had us out in that garden at a very, very young age. I don't remember this, but probably even as a baby, I was out there in the garden at one point or another while she worked away. How did you get interested, or how did it start for you?
Well, it's interesting. A similar story in that my mother was very involved. She was a real active gardener. And I recall growing up, I have two brothers, and I remember her trying to engage the three of us with gardening from the earliest age and giving us our own little plot of space to sow seeds and grow vegetables. And my brothers fought it tooth and nail, and I always enjoyed it, not just spending time with my mom, but I think I was hooked, you know, then and there.
Yeah.
And despite it becoming a little laborious as I got older and had other distractions, I think I've come full circle and realized the importance of that early exposure. But it, a lot of times it's just a matter of having that engagement to really set the hook and get interested.
Yeah. Is that the way to do it? What are some ways we can introduce kids to growing things?
Well, you know, I think it's important to clarify if it doesn't happen at a young age, it can happen at any point because, you know, with the current world events, more people are spending time out in their gardens, including amateurs and those that have thought, you know, I never used to have the time to get out there, and now I do. But what a great opportunity to engage the children. It can be as easy as a seed packet. I do think it's important to dedicate a little bit of space where they can explore and grow something that they like to grow. You don't want to start out with having it be a, hey, come out and help me weed for 5 hours. That's where you've lost them. But, you know, growing their own tomatoes, putting sunflower seeds in, and it's actually not too late to do a lot of this. We're starting to see a warming trend now, so it's certainly not too late to get these kids involved. But giving them early successes is important too. You know, you have to set some parameters, give them some guidance. But ultimately, you know, that first tomato that they've grown and they consume will be the best tomato they've ever had. They'll always remember it. And that's where you have gardeners for life. And I did that with both my daughters, and I'm happy to say they're both still gardening, which is great.
Oh, man. Yeah, my daughter Emily is, she enjoys it. She actually likes to weed. We started pulling Creeping Charlie in the grass a long time ago and had some fun with it. Now she'll weed around the garden and actually sit there and weed on her own for a long, long time. Dan in Washburn has something relating to this, I believe. Dan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Love your show up here. One of the things I did was I used to, stores like Menards, I'd pick up the 10 packets for a dollar, seed packets for a dollar, and mm-hmm. I'd just give my daughters a packet of seeds, and I'd say, go plant some garden. And they'd go out into the petunia bed or into the raspberry bed, and they'd plant their garden, and it led to things like, you know, a watermelon coming up in the raspberry bed, but it was such a delightful surprise to see where it would come from. And as a result, all three of my daughters all garden still. You know, because you made it fun. It was, how did that happen, that watermelon there, you know? And that first watermelon, by the way, they taste, that hooks them.
Oh, Dad, that's a great story. It pretty much goes along with what you were talking about, Mark Dwyer.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, it's interesting with my kids, having them plant beans, and you know, they're always asking, you know, can we pick them today? And you know, you get them hooked in the process. But to take a plant from seed to taking care of it, and then ultimately if it's fruiting or creating, you know, something edible, taking it through the process all the way to the kitchen is just wonderful. And that's why we're seeing such a huge surge in, you know, it's record sales of vegetable seeds. Again, current world events is prompting a lot of that, which I think is one of the few good things that's bringing people back out into the yard and connecting with the kids. But again, those early connections are so vital.
Yeah. Dan, thanks again. Appreciate it. What about the winter time? I mean, you know, how do you keep their interest alive in the winter?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can use my younger daughter as an example. She's 20 now, so she's still at home at this point. And she's amassed a huge houseplant collection. And so her love of plants extends through the year, and she's been nurturing houseplants, taking cuttings and starting new plants. She has a succulent collection, you know, cacti and other succulents. So with our four seasons in the Midwest here, you know, winter does become a little challenging, but it's not a bad time of year to do some planning, to go through the catalogs, to plan out next year's garden, and still be involved to some degree with plants inside the home.
Talking today with Mark Dwyer. He is former director of horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville and now has his own business called Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Questions for him as we talk a little about kids and gardening, but we'll take your general gardening questions as well at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And, well, let's take another call. Patricia in Madison, it's your turn now. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for accepting my call. I've got a problem with garden flocks. When we sold my parents' home, I moved some of the flocks to my yard, and I rue that day because they're overtaking my perennial garden. And how can I eradicate them? They really are so deep-rooted that they're extremely difficult to try to dig out.
Yeah. Flocks.
Yeah, the challenge, you know, garden flocks can have some reseeding. And, you know, the real issue you've alluded to is the deep-rooted nature, because aside from the hand-digging that can be laborious and take a lot of time, the danger is if your flocks have infiltrated a lot of your good plants, the challenge, if you're leaning towards a chemical application, is, you know, not damaging the desirables as you're trying to get rid of the flock. So aside from some good old-fashioned elbow grease, there's not anything selective that you can do other than the hand digging or some very specific spot treatment of herbicide, which again has its own challenges and implications. So I don't really have a good answer. I'm dancing around it a bit because there's so many plants that do this in our gardens. I have my own regrets at home where some things are infiltrating. And again, what I usually do is wait for after a nice rainy day when the soil's fairly soft, and then getting out there and just getting as much out as you can, knowing full well that you still have seeds that are likely viable for years. So it's not a one season approach. You've got to just keep on top of it.
Is there, can you just cut it back before the seeds have a chance to form and drop and just keep doing that?
Well, with garden flocks, you could, you know, not letting it bloom would mitigate the seeding issue, but they would still be there. You know, they would, as a perennial, they would still come back. And so, yeah, the challenge is ultimately having to deal with that mama plant.
Yeah, yeah. Patricia, there's a fair amount of work ahead for you, I'm afraid. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I don't know. I believe, Mark, you have access to photos that people are sending in and emailing in. Have you got your computer handy there?
Yes, I'm looking at a couple of the photos right now.
Pat in Bayfield emailed that the heavy snow and vole chewing have made a mess of her established beautiful bridal wreath spirea plantings. Should she cut them down to about 18 inches and start over, or would that kill them? If she prunes out the chewed and snow-broken branches, it'll look pretty bad. So she's wondering what you suggest.
Yes, and you know, I'm looking at those photos, and boy, the damage is significant. To answer her question, though, you absolutely can cut them severely back. So I would even go maybe below 18 inches, maybe down to a foot. The danger with that type of spirea, and I wouldn't say it's a danger, but she should expect it'll take 2 to 3 years for them to really come back. Some of the other types of spireas respond very quickly to that type of pruning. So by cutting those back now, removing all of those dead and broken branches, she'll see some regrowth this year. Next year, it won't flower. It'll continue to regrow, but hopefully in the second or third year, it'll be back to its original splendor. So I don't think it warrants removal. If I had the same situation at home, I would do what she's already suggested, and that's that severe cutback, because that's a vigorous shrub, and it should bounce back. The hope is you don't have repeated vole damage on your renewed plant in the future, so just have to be cognizant of that as well.
Lucia emailed a photo of a pine tree. It's not coming back very well. She wonders if you might know what the issue is or where she can ask for help. We've got a photo of it.
It is a spruce tree, but something she should what we're looking at, Larry, is, of course, a lot of browning on the needles. And the nice thing is all those plump buds there, there's some new candling going on, so some new growth. That might be, we had a little bit of that warming and a little cool weather come in, and I've seen evergreens with some of this browning recover fully. So I would encourage her to send this photo to the local extension agent just to make sure there's nothing else in the area or something that might be ring a bell with the extension agent. But the browning of needles on pines and spruce is not unusual. And there is a needle drop involved with many evergreens, but this looks like something a little different that I think is weather-related. And back to my earliest comment, I think that flush of all those buds, I think that plant's going to be okay is my gut feeling.
And Chad emailed a photo of a plant, white flowers. He's noticing in ditches, wants to know what it is and if it's invasive.
Yeah, I'm looking at that same photo, and it's a stumper for me because, you know, it looks very Queen's Anne's lace in appearance, although we're a ways from seeing Queen Anne's lace bloom. My concern is a receding issue in terms of colonizing, but in terms of a positive ID, I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, it's probably need a little better look at the plant itself, a little closer look.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bill in Racine has a question for you. Let's go there. Bill, hello.
Hi. Say, I'm wondering, I've got a very uneven lawn. Basically, maybe 20 years ago when we had the place built, we put in sod and it was nice and, you know, level and all that other good stuff. So it just got progressively worse. And about 2 years ago, I did get it aerated. Guy told me or whatever, I don't want to name the firm, he said this will really even it out, and that didn't work at all. So is there anything I can do? And in my memory, I remember my dad or a neighbor had one of these rollers, I don't know, filled with water or something. What's the best approach to level this out?
A bumpy lawn. What about it, Mark?
Yeah, you know, bumpy lawn, there's a couple different things you can do. And the aeration was likely good for the lawn, but that typically won't deal with the issue of, the changes in grade. I will say at Rotary Gardens in Janesville, we did have a roller, and we would fill it with water, and it would end up being about 300, 350 pounds of pressure. And we would wait until after a light rain when it was just a little soft and get out there and roll. That would take care of some of the most minor bumps and grooves. The danger then is you're compacting the soil as well. You know, you're smushing things down and trying to even it. We would then follow up that process with aeration. So we would kind of smush it down and then aerate it to loosen it up but hopefully it would. And this did, again, deal with some of the minor grade changes. Now, if you can see some of the little valleys and dips and such, another way of approaching it is threading in some new topsoil and smoothing it out. So in essence, not removing any turf, and I don't know the scale or extent of the changes in grade or if this is a massive area, but by putting some nice topsoil in like physically leveling and covering all those dips and then reseeding right over the top, you can actually deal with some of the same problems by just adding a little soil. So again, I'm not sure how realistic that is, but you may want to start with the roller approach, because I know in many cases you can rent those rollers for a day or a half day and give it a whirl. But do keep in mind my comments about adding soil and doing some overseeding as well.
Yeah, and then once you roll it, probably a good idea to aerate it, as you were saying.
Mark. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Mark Dwyer, our guest today, he is owner and head person at Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with Mark Dwyer of Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening in. Give a call with your questions, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo you want to send along, please email that as well. Let's take another call. Michelle in Oregon, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hello. I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to say that during the COVID shutdown, I have two little girls. One's about to turn 7, and she loves everything nature, pine cones on our walk to earthworms, everything. So we started her own little garden spot. We went to Kopke's and got some flowers, some annuals and some perennials, and she filled up a box, and I've been documenting pictures of the growth and with her in it. And I'm going to make a Shutterfly book, and I'm going to name it, you know, the COVID-19 Garden. And when she's older, she can share it with her children and tell her about how she lived through it and have the progress of the flowers growing.
Oh, what a wonderful idea, Michelle, isn't it, Mark?
I think that's awesome. I'm warm and fuzzy hearing that because I had similar stories, but I think that is awesome. And the idea of the Shutterfly book, and you've created a gardener for life, and her children and her grandchildren, your great-grandchildren will all be gardeners. And I think it's absolutely wonderful. And, you know, there is space in our gardens to allow children to explore and to enjoy it. And, you know, letting kids pick some of their own plants and that care, that nurturing, I think is so important. And it's pretty easy to get focused on the negative things in life right now, but gardening is something we can all have in common. And this huge resurgence towards, the redo of a victory garden, the idea of growing a lot of vegetables at home, is back. And what an opportunity we should all embrace.
Yeah. Michelle, you're a good mom. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Chris in West Bend has something. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
All right. I have a couple red pine trees that I've planted probably in 2012. They have just gotten about 3 feet or so and have stopped growing, and I've recently looked at the trunk and some of the branches coming off near the trunk, and there's this black, I don't know if it's mold or fungus or what, but I suspect that's why it's not growing. Is there any sort of herbicide, or do you know what that is, that so I could maybe treat the trees?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think that's one, it'd be great to see a photo or share that photo, again, with your local extension service, because what you're seeing is that the black may not be the problem. It might be some sort of a fungal reaction based on something else that's going on. So the fact that the growth has been arrested and slowed down, it's obvious something's going on. But again, what you're seeing may be more symptomatic and not what's exactly the problem. So tough without a photo, but I think, again, there's some wonderful extension folks that might be able to narrow down ear problem, including Dr. Huddleston at UW-Madison, who specializes in some of those things as well.
If you get some good pictures, photos, Chris, you could send them to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, would take a look at those photos and might be able to give you a lot more information. It's pretty easy to do. Just look up UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, PDDC, I think is the acronym, Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Send him a few photos, close-ups, and he may be able to help. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Elizabeth in Sheboygan, it's your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Well, I have quite a large yard, and what we would like to do is keep the front half of the yard regular grass, but we would like to have the last back half of the yard go to prairie or do a natural prairie. I'm just wondering the best way to go about that on a very limited budget.
Yeah, what size are we talking about for that prairie area?
It's going to be about a quarter of an acre.
Okay. And is it pretty much, is it shaded or is it pretty open?
It's open. It's full sunshine all day. And it is, right now it's, normal lawn.
Okay. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I think I like the idea of that approach because the inherent value, of course, of that prairie for wildlife and pollinators and such is inherent. I think a lot of us should do more of that. My warning is that the real challenge is not so much establishing the prairie, but making sure you've eliminated your existing turf and any weed problems. And I'll use an example. At Rotary Gardens, we have a prairie restoration, and 30 years ago, when it was seeded in, it was seeded very quickly after some initial weed removal, and the problem was the weed seed bank was so extensive that we've spent the last 30 years trying to get rid of the weeds. So it wasn't a clean slate to start with. So again, eliminating, making sure the grass is out of there, and then making the decision of you're going to install plugs or seed or a combination of those approaches. And Wisconsin is blessed with some of the best native plant nurseries in the country. And I would lean you towards Prairie Nursery in Westfield. The owner, Neil Dibble, is extremely knowledgeable in how to approach these things and has installed prairies and given advice. And this isn't as much an endorsement for his business because there are other vendors that sell wonderful native plants. But in terms of an approach in a residential scale, I think he would be a great resource. So it's a matter of just following the right steps. And with the budgetary concerns, that's a lot of plants to put in even a smaller space like that. So that decision on seed versus plugs and plants is something he could help you with as well.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of information just online at his Prairie Nursery website. There's a whole bunch of information. And, of course, prices on seeds and plugs and so forth. So take a look, Elizabeth, there. And there are other places as well. But Mark, I think, has a good suggestion for you there, Prairie Nursery. But you do, and you'll see that when you go to the website, you do really need to start with a clean slate if you want to not have to spend 30 years picking out the weeds. There you go. But once it's established, you got a good setup, and then you get it established, Mark, you got a beautiful thing that's going to attract a lot of pollinators and other wildlife.
Right, that matrix of native grasses and forbs is what you want. And what happened at Rotary was just the infiltration initially of the Canadian thistle and just a lot of real problematic weeds that are difficult to then extract from all the good stuff,
Yeah, for sure. Good luck, Elizabeth. Good idea, and I hope you follow through. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Karen in Marinette. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. I love your show. Listen to it every Friday. Get a lot of good information, so that's great.
Thank you.
I had actually emailed you some pictures of my crabapple tree in bloom last year. And what I had taken pictures of was the trunk was girdled low to the ground. And I asked you if it could be saved. And the answer I got was probably not. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to report that I did some more research because I wanted to save the tree. It was 6 years old. And we planted it when we first moved in our new house. So what I did was put sphagnum moss around the girdle part and then wrapped it with the tree bark and kept it moist. And this year it's in full bloom. So I'm hoping that this did the trick. Is that possible?
Well, it sounds like it's possible. It may be. Well, Mark, go ahead and comment.
Well, I hope it's the case where the tree is recovered, because I don't know the history on how it was girdled. One of the issues with girdling, though, is it can take more than a year to kill a tree. So I don't want to throw any negativity, because I do hope everything works out for the crabapple. But, you know, keep an eye on it, because if there's continued decline, sometimes, again, that girdling can take even a couple years to kill a tree.
Yeah, and it depends. I mean, if it girdled, okay. If it if there was some bark left, there's a possibility that it would come back. But if it was clean, all the bark off, that would not be a very good sign all the way around the tree, for sure. But, hey, hope springs eternal, Karen. Hang in there. Keep a good eye on it. Thanks for calling. Elaine in Hartford, your turn. Hi, Elaine.
Hi there. I'm calling to inquire about garlic mustard, which I know is a problem for everyone. You know, how does one begin to eradicate it? I have kind of a prairie area that's been taken over by that.
Hmm. How big is your prairie area?
You know, a quarter, I don't know, I'll say a quarter acre, I don't really know, but I'm just interested in, it seems impossible to pull it out. How do you begin?
Yeah, the challenge, you know, a couple of things with the garlic mustard. So it's a biennial, so it takes 2 years to go from seed to bloom. So earlier this year, as it was going into bloom, all those white flowers, that's the second year of the plant, and I think many of us know it, you know, it drops a lot of seed that's viable for many, many years. So dovetailing onto that comment, if you were to magically be able to remove all of the plants you see now, you still have years of weeding because of the seeds. So you have to commit to a good decade of removal, which it's a battle that you have to commit to. The nice thing about garlic mustard, though, in terms of identifying it, is it stays green through the winter. So what you're seeing as you get into fall, we've had a couple frosts, everything is browning out. The first year rosettes of garlic mustard are very identifiable. They're this, you know, kind of a crinkled green leaf. You can certainly look up photos to help identify it, but it stays green quite late in the season, so it's a little easier to identify and then target, whether that's manual removal, which certainly could be a lot, or herbicide application, which again has all its implications. I don't want to tell anyone to use chemicals or not use chemicals. That's a personal choice. But something that I've seen done on larger scales is, because it's a biennial, the second year plants, when they're just getting ready to bloom, there's been a concerted effort to constantly remove the blossoms. So in its second year, when it's trying to bloom, now, this is dangerous because if the timing's off, it can send up a new flower stalk and reseed. But there are ways to time its removal to have it die its second year without going to seed. And that gets a bit more complicated, so I do a little more research on that. But I'm rambling on here, but it's again, a concerted effort to deal with what's going to be a nightmare. And at Rotary Gardens, we had acres of it in the woods, and it's been a 30-year commitment of constantly removing it, thinking we've gotten it all and realizing we haven't. So I hate to preach doom and gloom, but it's going to be a challenge.
There you go, Elaine. Some work ahead, not only this year, but a few years down the road at least. Ron in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ron.
an idea for the lady with the girdled crabapple tree. Years ago, I read in the text and the pictures on bridge grafting, and they would have to take thin twigs of an apple tree, possibly the same tree, and someone successful at grafting would have to do the installation. But one end of the twig goes under the live bark below the girdled area, and the top end of the twig goes into under the bark into the cambium above. And you might have to put in a dozen or 20 twigs to save a tree that was several inches in diameter. I must confess, as a teenager, I tried grafting my parents' apple trees with zero success rate. Commercial grafting wax probably would have been a smart investment and not waste all of my hours of time. I was curious, though, my question is about the soils at the Rotary Garden in Janesville. I'm dreaming of helping folks install a rain garden in Janesville, and I wondered how wet the soils are down there and what sort of native plants or even, well, what sort of plants would survive on those soils? Are they, you know, sandy, droughty ones or clay, real wet ones or intermediate?
Right. Well, and I should mention that the challenge, the 20-acre site of Rotary Gardens is on the site of an old sand and gravel pit. So it's a little different than the rest of Janesville. So Rotary Gardens has sharp drainage, neutral soils. But around Janesville, there's very little clay. It's some of the best farmland in the state. So it's a lot of really good soil. So I don't know that you'll have a lot of challenges in terms of overly heavy soils or perpetually damp soils. So it's spotty depending on where you are. I did want to say for listeners, you mentioned the bridge grafting. Folks should get online and look that up. It's very fascinating and something to take a look at. It looks crazy, but the concept is sound. And I was rethinking this lady's crabapple, and I'm thinking maybe the girdling didn't go deep enough to affect the cambium layer, the xylem and phloem. Maybe the girdling you know, there was some allowance for the movement of food and water. So I do hope it survives. But for folks, do look up that bridge grafting. It's just interesting to see.
And Ron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Tom in Galesville next. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi, you guys. Great to talk with you. I just had a I probably get this question a lot. I just would like to get rid of Creeping Charlie in our lawn, and we also got a couple horses last fall, and I'd like to clear their pasture land too. On one of your shows last fall, they mentioned a product called Iron X, which I thought would be ecologically safe, but I bought some, and it didn't seem to do anything. Do you have any other thoughts of what I can safely put down that would leave that would be okay for the horses in a couple months?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Iron X. Larry, do you recall the?
I'm trying to remember, and I don't recall. The Iron X might have been for the Creeping Charlie.
Yeah, the Creeping Charlie. Yeah, Creeping Charlie is it's difficult. There's no doubt it's difficult to remove. And I will say, and I continue to use examples from my former workplace at Rotary Gardens, but we would actually, in select areas where it was thick, we would rent a sod cutter and set it at maximum depth so it would cut about 2 inches down. And we would actually cut out areas with Creeping Charlie and then add new soil and then reseed. And inevitably, there'd be a couple little sprigs here and there that would come up, but we were manually removing it. And in some cases, some herbicide was warranted. So I'm not familiar with other products, and I know it's come up on the show, Larry, where there's some products that have been promoted that seem to really diminish its vigor out in the landscape. But I'm wary of recommending something I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And, you know, I simply, you know, daughter Emily and I have sat there in the lawn and pulled it. And of course, you're not getting it all. But in a lawn situation, if you can get ahead of it, and if you treat your lawn area well, mowing high and so forth, you can knock it back. A couple of hours out in the lawn with two people, you'd be amazed at how much you can pull up. And then good, you know, lawn practices really can make a difference. So there you go, Tom. Thanks. The only other way that I can think of is, you know, chemically you can remove it for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you may, you know, some people are fine doing that. Others would rather not do that. So, but even then, it can come back. If the neighbors have it, you're going to eventually get it back. There's almost no way to stop it as far as I can tell. I once did eliminate, I had so much of it at a different home that I had on the lake, on Lake Monona. I completely eliminated the lawn and started all over again. And within a few years, the Creeping Charlie was creeping back in.
Mm-hmm.
from the neighbors. And I had a perfect lawn for a year or two, and the Creepy Charlie was back. So mm-hmm. constant battle. Tom, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Sheila are in Escanaba, Michigan. Your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello. I've got a problem with daylilies. My mother made the mistake of planting some on my dad's grave. And I want to know how to get rid of them.
Are these standard daylilies, or are they reminiscent of what some folks will call ditch lilies, the real tall, orange-blooming amaryllis? Do you recall the appearance?
Real tall stalk, orange flowers on the top.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, the real challenge with them is it's not too dissimilar to some of the other things we've talked about with the earlier conversation about phlox and just recently here with the Creeping Charlie, in that to successfully remove them, you have to have all the rhizotomous, all the bulbous root sections removed as well. So even with typical cultivated daylilies or ditch lilies, everything we're talking about here, if it's a manual removal, you've got to have every little piece out. So even after you've dug it, you come back in 2 weeks and you dig the small pieces that are coming back. So if manual removal is possible, it's just repeated coming back to it, or to a point where the leaves that are coming up are so thin, then you could do a little spritz of herbicide. Certainly herbicide would take care of it. So there's also that, but ultimately, again, that's a personal choice, but it can be done. Just again, know it's another one of these battles where it's a plant that will do everything it can to survive, and that root system is extensive in terms of regenerating growth.
Thank you for calling, Sheila. Appreciate your call. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. You can join in with your garden questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Dwyer. His business, new business name is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Great to have him along, and certainly if you have questions for him, we've talked a bit about getting children involved in gardening. That's been a lot of fun. We've had some great stories and comments from you, and we really appreciate that. But we've been taking a pretty broad range of garden questions. So again, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Monica in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Monica, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I had a question in regards to a pussy willow tree in my backyard.
Okay.
It bloomed early this spring, and we had a couple of frosts. And I was worried that, you know, the pollinators wouldn't get to it in time, and just because it was so cold. And now that it's leafed out, I have noticed that where those blooms are on the branches, it's died back. There's no growth. It's just those spent flowers that are there. And is this normal? I moved into this house recently. It looks like it's been chopped down at the base a couple times because there's two stumps where the main trunk emerges from. And is this a problem? Should I start like propagating it in different places? What's going on?
Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, well, it's tough to say. One thing I would jump right to the fact that it's difficult to kill a willow. So in the fact that you've seen it cut back in the past with pussy willows, and particularly when they're used for cut arrangements. Because a pussy willow wants to get quite large. So in situations where they're specifically grown as a cut flower arrangement, they're constantly cut back to get new growth, to get the youngest growth, vigorous growth. I think what you're observing where the flowers were, if the leaves look healthy, I would not worry at all about your plant. I don't know that what you're seeing is unusual or problematic, but do keep in mind, if you make the decision to cut back that willow, you certainly could do it later in the season or late winter and get a lot more vigorous growth. You'd likely lose some of the spring flowers, which is the beautiful look, but you would have a rejuvenated, shorter plant. So I'm giving a lot of words to the fact that based on what you've said, I wouldn't worry about it at all.
No, I wouldn't either. They are really hard to kill, for sure. Thanks, Monica. Doug in Waniwok, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
We have a pond in our property, and there's sections of it where the grass just does not grow well, and it's right next to the pond. But moss seems to be growing fairly decent, but it's not total covering. I was wondering if there's a way of filling in those bare patches and whatnot, make more green, more moss or grass. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mark, what do you think?
Well, question, is the mossy area, does the level of the pond fluctuate where it raises and comes over that section?
No, not really. I mean, it raises up pretty good sometimes during, really heavy, heavy rainstorms, but it's never gone over. It's like earthen dam, basically.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
But it definitely does get up into that grassy area sometimes, and it's in the middle where nothing seems to grow.
Yeah, no, I understand. And, what's interesting is, first of all, with moss growing there, a lot of times people errantly think that moss is displacing turf grass. And in all cases where you see moss growing, it's just more conducive to moss as opposed to the grass. So that location will be problematic, likely for even trying grass. So I would move away from that and make a decision on, you alluded to maybe encouraging more moss, and that is possible. At Rotary Gardens, we had two moss gardens where we were encouraging moss to grow, and it was just filling in beautifully. Being inundated with water, that was my concern. If the water level covers the moss for any lengthy period of time, it could be problematic. But the other consideration is maybe some shoreline, some plants that can take periodic high water levels, but also are great rooted along the edge of a water body. So with your pond, I don't know if it was turf all the way to the edges, or if you have sporadic plantings to help deal with erosion. And there's certainly a lot of native plants that could take exactly that location. So what I would do is, my personal opinion is, don't even try to do grass anymore and lean towards the encouragement of that moss or the inclusion of more appropriate shoreline plantings. And I think you'll have a nice clean look then.
Yeah. Would rain garden plants work in there, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. If you Google up rain gardens, the plants that'll take periodic, inundation of water, but then can take some of the summer dryness. And there are plants that will do that. So there's a whole spectrum of plants available to you to take care of that shoreline. Cause it sounds like it's the sparse look right now is what you don't want. And you can fill that back in.
Yeah, for sure. And there's some really pretty rain garden plants that would could add a lot to that, to the look that you have out there, Doug. Thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Casey emailed at ideas@wpr.org. And she lives in a group home, would like some tips on growing an indoor herb garden without creating a mess. She's in a group home.
Well, you know, an indoor herb garden is a great idea. I will say one of the challenges is, number one, adequate lighting. So even putting herbs, now supplemental lighting is certainly something to consider, but putting them in a west-facing window is a start. But, you know, the majority of our herbs will thrive outside in our gardens with the heat of our summer and full sun situations. So replicating that inside becomes a challenge, not only with the lighting I've mentioned, but temperature. So when you consider, particularly in winter, a home that's quite dry and around 70 degrees is not conducive to herbs thriving. So a year-round indoor herb garden presents its own set of challenges that can be taken hand-in-hand. In terms of keeping it, you know, contained and not too messy, there's all sorts of wonderful containers and situations that can be set up in interior situations for herbs. So you can grow your basils, your rosemary, your sages. It can all be done. But again, the challenge in our climate is, again, the lighting, the heating, humidity, and the winter.
I was trying to think of a good spot, a place to look online for indoor herb gardens. And maybe if you just Google it, something will come up. But do you have any suggestions along those lines?
Well, I think, Larry, that as a Google search, that's exactly what you'd want to do, indoor herb gardens. And there's already kits that can be sent out that include even some of the lighting, full spectrum lighting, grow lights in essence, to have your herbs. And the assumption is you're utilizing these herbs, cutting back on them, doing your thing. You know, the other opportunity, if there's any ability to grow them outside, even near a door or a patio or an area full sun in containers, there's a lot to be said about good air circulation outside, the lighting and the heat. So I keep returning to the fact that inside can be challenging because of how we keep the climate in our homes and some of the limited lighting. But it certainly can be done with a little bit of research.
Speaking of that, Ned in Florence emailed to ask if you could recommend a book for a 10-year-old beginning gardener. He ordered two books online, was disappointed. One showed how to do lots of stuff that were pretty difficult and or not suited for the North. The other was too childish for a child who's proud of reading fairly well for his age.
Boy, off the top of my head, I can't specifically for that age level. However, I will say an organization to look into and something that all listeners may want to consider is the American Horticultural Society is a wonderful organization. They send out a bi-monthly magazine and have all sorts of events. On an annual basis, they've hosted, it's called a Youth and Gardening Conference, and educators and professionals from around the country attend. I've gone a couple times. But they've amassed and created a huge amount of literature and support for getting kids involved with gardening. And I would encourage folks to get on the American Horticultural Society website. I believe there are links to various youth-based activities, perhaps resources like books, and also connecting with their staff for some ideas. And then you can kind of winnow it down to a specific age category or grade level. And that's my best advice. But that group is wonderful, and they're doing a lot of great work with kids, and that's one of their huge priorities. Again, American Horticultural Society.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I love that idea. Also, he might just want to go to UW Extension, the learning store, UW Extension Learning Store, something like that. There's a lot of bulletins and publications on growing all kinds of things, vegetables, flowers, and so forth. And it's written at, you know, for an average reader. It's not written in a fashion that is too highfalutin or anything like that. It's pretty straightforward. Might even want to take a look at the what's available at the UW Extension Learning Store. So another place to look. Colleen and Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Just calling about a wisteria plant. It's been, sorry about the barking. It's about, like 10 years old. Pretty, very healthy, but past couple of years doesn't really bloom much.
Okay.
And looking for any suggestions.
How do you get the wisteria to bloom?
And so you have seen it bloom in the past, though?
Yes. Yeah, I think up until the last year or two.
Okay. Yeah, if you have seen it bloom in the past, one of the things I would recommend is later in the season, and if you don't see it, it should be blooming now or very shortly. If you don't see it blooming this season, what you may want to consider is some severe cutback over the winter months. And rejuvenate it, and hopefully it'll be back.
Yeah, you can certainly do that. Mark Dwyer is our guest speaker, educator, author. His new business is named Landscape Prescriptions by MD. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Mark Dwyer, speaker, educator, author, has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. So what gardening questions do you have? Join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Certainly love to hear from you. Richard in Two Rivers has a question for us, Mark. So let's go to Richard. Hi. Thanks for calling.
I got a question, but I just want to let you know I went out this morning fishing and I got 11 for 15, and 4 kings and 7 rainbows.
Woo. Good for you, Richard.
Well, you could have been out. You got to get off this radio show. But the question I have is, I did pediatrics for 5 years on the border of Mexico, working with underprivileged Hispanic children, and I know children. And I also have, thanks to Larry, I have straw bale or hay bale gardening, and I have a really nice garden. And I take kids out to it and try to teach them how to garden. And there are some kids that I need help with, that they touch dirt and they're a fall. And I know how to deal with children, especially if they're autistic, because I worked with autistic children for many years. But, I mean, these are children that are normal. And how do you take a child that doesn't want to get dirty and teach him how to garden? That's my question.
All right.
Yeah, that's a great question, because there is a huge disconnect with a lot of kids that have never had that opportunity. And what we found at Rotary Gardens, as we were engaging children, different groups that would come in, and one of my jobs in running the gardens was to schedule planting days and have these groups come in. And I was amazed at kids that were even in the 7th, 8th grade, even high school age, that had never planted and had some aversion to getting dirty. And it wasn't so much a fear of the soil as, they just simply didn't want to get dirty. They weren't necessarily dressed for the activity. I will say something that worked well for us was, if kids wanted to observe to start with, we would let that happen. We would make sure we had gloves for the kids. And we would kind of explain the process of what's going on and talk about the importance of soil and the fact that, you know, what's going to be happening with these plants. So it's not just an immediate, literal and figurative immersion into the soil. It's kind of explaining the process of how plants are growing. And it was amazing that the vast percentage of these kids would then get engaged and were having a blast. And so it's kind of, every child is different.
but giving the opportunities early and often and working with them. And, you know, again, with each child being different, there are situations where it might be a little more difficult than others, but that positive support, the reinforcement, and making it a fun activity, obviously, is a great avenue as well.
Yeah, good points. Richard, good luck. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck with that fishing. That's pretty cool. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Steve emailed to ask, why are you supposed to mound up soil around potato plants, and when can you stop hilling them? He started some in pots. He's hilled them a few times. They're maybe 2 feet tall from the roots up. He says he will have to transplant them in order to accommodate a higher hill, but does he need to? What can he expect to happen if he doesn't?
Oh, so he's already been hilling some of the potatoes. Yeah.
In pots.
Right. Well, the reason to hill potatoes, whether they're in containers or out in the garden, is to increase yield. And it's not as important in containers when it becomes difficult to it sounds like he's mounding soil on a container maybe that can't accommodate more soil. So one of the concerns with potatoes in containers is having an adequate depth container. That's why you see out in the garden, as potatoes are hilled, the hills can get quite substantial, again, with the opportunity of producing, increasing the yield. So if it's to a point where he can't hill them anymore, I wouldn't worry as much about it. You'll still have potatoes, but consider perhaps deeper pots or a system where you can accommodate the increased height. Like I've seen slatted containers where slats are added to add height to contain different levels, you know, additional levels of hilling. So some of it's potato variety dependent. The season is a huge factor as well. But again, I don't think he's doing anything wrong. He's just reached the limit perhaps of what that container can accommodate.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. And I don't know if he could transplant. I don't know how you'd... It would be a tough... I think I'd just stay with the pots and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And maybe next year you want to go with... some people are even using a sort of, making a tube of chicken wire and filling, you know, kind of filling it up as the plant grows.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have potatoes coming in and leaves and plants, so forth, coming out the sides of the of the tube. And it's a pretty cool situation, because then when you're ready to harvest, you just take it apart and everything falls out, and there they are, the potatoes.
Right. Perfect.
Jennifer emailed that the day after she planted a green velvet boxwood, a quarter of the leaves turned a yellowish-white color over the next couple of days. This continued to spread. Now half of the bush looks like it's died off. When she loosened up the sides and base of the roots to plant it, do you think she inadvertently damaged one of the root lines? Does she just clip off all the dead branches and wait to see if it'll recover, or should she replace now?
Well, you know, she should. Green velvet, I think, is the best boxwood for our area, and she shouldn't feel bad about anything she did to the roots, because boxwoods are tough as nails. So when it came out of the container, if she were roughing them up, snipping them, widening them out, that was all perfect. My concern is that boxwood maybe came from an area where there's a lot of there's a boxwood blight. There's other fungal issues that are affecting boxwoods, so it may have come with a problem. And that browning of the foliage is one of the symptoms. So my recommendation to her is to trim all that out. But first of all, the branches that have lost the leaves, or the leaves are brown, bend them to see if they're pliable, or scratch them, see if they're still green, because they might regenerate some growth. My guess is if they're brittle and dry, that progression of problems will go through most of the shrub. So if it continues to look worse, I would get rid of it, because the concern again is the perpetuation of this blight or something else that's happening. Because green velvet is tough as nails, and I've rarely seen that issue on boxwoods that don't have these problems.
There we go. Steve emailed a suggestion for the gentleman who wants to clear his horse pasture of unwanted vegetation. get a couple of goats in there first. It's possible for them to cohabitate with horses if their individual temperaments are compatible. Just have to be sure the fencing is goat secure. They're great at killing unwanted and wanted, if you're not careful, plants. And they're hilarious creatures. And that's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea at all. Joan in Lake Nabagamon called to ask for recommendations for grass that may grow in an area near pines where it's shady and the grass there is now spotty. She doesn't want a ground cover, which is what would have been the first suggestion probably, or a mulch. What do you think, Mark?
Well, there's lots of grasses that'll take the shady conditions under a pine, which typically is a little more acidic soil because of the pine needles, which isn't a bad thing. The other concern, though, would be moisture. So my assumption is something new that I'll recommend here, she would have to do some additional supplemental watering to establish these plants initially, because dry shade is challenging for a lot of plants. But there's a wide range of native sedges that would do well, clumping sedges that would form kind of a matrix. There's Carex pennsylvanica or Pennsylvania sedge, which does spread a little bit. It's not, I wouldn't classify it as a ground cover per se, but it's a great, wonderful, very short sedge that would take up that space. There's also Hakone grass, golden Hakone grass, and I'm actually not sure where in the state she is in terms of hardiness, but this is a grass that would take a zone 5 type winter.
She's in northern Wisconsin.
Okay, I would avoid the Hakone grass unless you're closer to the lake up there. If it's sold in your area, it's worth trying. I would ask around at local garden centers and nurseries for shade-tolerant sedges and get a combination of clumping sedges. And there's a wide range of other perennials that'll take those conditions, like epimediums, or barrenworts, pulmonarias, hellebores. So in lieu of all grass, she could do, again, a combination of different plants. But the moisture is going to be imperative for establishing everything I've mentioned.
Yeah, for sure. Jane in Waukegan, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Hi. Listen, I have a magnolia tree that is probably about 18 years old, and it did suffer some, I thought, frost damage last year. But this year, I'm seeing splits in the trunks of the four trunks. There's splits that are happening, and they're seeping sap and attracting ants. And I don't know what I might be able to do.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, magnolias are notoriously thin-barked, which is a concern, of course. It's not unusual to see cracking sometimes on the south or west side of a trunk. And the fact that you have active oozing and some moisture issues and other things is of concern. If you didn't see, now I'll back up and say I've got two magnolias at home and both suffered from late frost. And the leaves are stunted and crinkled, but they're kind of flushing through that. And they had decent blooms until the frost knocked them off. So my magnolias are looking a little ratty. You have the added concern, of course, of the trunks. So, you know, keeping an eye on it, of course, it might just be a tough year for that magnolia. But if you see further decline with the foliage, if it starts blackening and shriveling, I would take a sample to your extension agent and get some sort of diagnosis or prognosis on what's happening. Your description concerns me a lot. I worry a lot about what might be happening, and it could have started with some of the weather conditions, but there might be some other stress happening as well.
There you go, Jane. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to another email. Ben in Minneapolis emailed to say he recently removed and moved some hydrangeas and turned that area into lawn. He says he clearly didn't get all the roots and they keep popping up. Can he just continue to pull out the sprouts and eventually the roots will give up, or does he have to go back and dig it all up again?
Well, it's likely smooth hydrangea, the puffball types. And the root system is fairly shallow on those. And I guess what I should jump to the chase and say, I would get back there and dig them out. And I know you probably have some nice grass establishing. Snipping them back, you'll never get rid of it. They'll just keep sprouting. So you need to sacrifice a little turf and get in there and with some elbow grease and get them out.
Yeah, that makes the most sense. Kathy emailed to say, wonders why the lilacs in the Wausau area are blooming so poorly. Any thoughts as to why? We've had some good blooms, I think, in the Madison area. So what about Wausau?
Yeah, it's tough to say because, Larry, I would agree with you. I went to Longnecker Gardens at the UW Arboretum during peak lilac time, and I'd have to say I've never seen the lilacs look better. Mm-hmm. And we had extended bloom on the south part of the state due to the, you know, the cool temperatures we had a couple weeks ago. So Wausau would have been, you know, a week and a half delayed from our area further south. So my only concern is some of the cooler weather conditions might have had an impact. It's really tough to say because that surprises me. You know, maybe her description is based on they didn't bloom real well, but if we have a cooler summer, as we've had the last 3 years, and a lot of moisture, there could be mildew issues and other fungal problems associated with lilacs, and those symptoms will be seen shortly as it heats up. So if these are lilacs in our home landscape, I would keep an eye on them. But lilacs are pretty tough, and I think they'll be all right in the long run.
You know, as long as we're talking lilacs, once the flowering period is over, and if you've got some lilac plantings that are not blooming well, you know, right after that bloom period, that's a good time to get in there, isn't it, Mark, and just cut the biggest, maybe third of the plant back right to the ground?
Right. Well, you think about the old French lilacs, the real tall ones, taking the third of the taking the largest canes out, the oldest portion of the plant, which can be done anytime because you're ultimately losing those flowers regardless. You could even do that in the winter months. But if you have smaller lilacs, Miss Kim lilacs, Dwarf Korean, some of the smaller stature lilacs, your shearing or cutting or pruning is right after they bloom because they do flower on old wood. So you need to be careful with the timing, but you're right, Larry, we're heading into the best time of year to prune lilacs is very shortly.
Cheryl in Verona has a question. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We have a really old begonia plant. I'm sorry, peony plants. And this is the first year that they've turned brown, the leaves, and have and really are not, don't look like they're actually going to have any blooms this year.
Yeah, that's a real concern. You know, the peonies in my home in Janesville are just opening up and are looking fairly good. Peonies are near indestructible. So if every stem, if the entire plant has turned brown and withered down, I would encourage you to dig it up and move it. And it's a woody root mass. It's a huge amount of digging. But that rejuvenation, it would take a year or two for it to really settle in and recover. Because the real time you want to move peonies is later in the season, late summer, early fall. But there might be something with that site. Something may have happened in that space that's problematic for your peony. But I wouldn't count it out in terms of it being dead yet. And having not seen it, I'm not sure of its status. But it's not something that's unheard of in terms of a decline with peonies. But again, that rejuvenation with a relocation is I think, warranted.
Yeah. You know, I like to have flowers going as early as I can. I think I've got 16 pots out of peonies peonies and marigolds primarily, but a whole range of colors and so forth that are stuck in my areas of the garden, flower garden, where there isn't anything flowering right now other than the iris, and it's nice to see those little spots of color in and out among the green plants. I really enjoy doing that every year. It's really not too expensive once you have all the pots.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Well, Ruth, in a couple of things here, Ruth in Middleton emailed to remind gardeners who have moss, and we've had a question or two about moss, birds use it in their nests. So moss is a good nesting material for birds.
Yeah, it's a great material, and it has a, you know, a 400 million year history. Moss is an interesting plant, and again, the moss gardens at Rotary Gardens, there's a little more manicuring going on, but in the state of Wisconsin, there's like 400 native species of moss, and there's reasons it grows where it does, and it has an unbelievable amount of benefit. And there's entire books on moss gardening, which is not a new concept. It's thousands of years old, but interesting plant.
Yeah, for sure, and can be very beautiful. The gardens, the moss gardens, can be really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, how has your business been affected? Here you are, you got a new business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. How's that been affected by COVID-19? There's some challenges there, for sure.
You know, Larry, thanks for asking. There are, as there are for so many other people, but, you know, with my speaking engagements, of course, dried up for obvious reasons, you know, we don't want crowds congregating and such. But to some of our earlier comments about getting out in the garden this year and getting the kids involved, I think a lot more folks are at home more often and are deciding this is the year to get out in the garden. So my consultation and design business is going gangbusters, I'm happy to say. And I'm following all social distancing recommendations, but ultimately it's been real exciting to help folks out. And this is, I think, with all the negative things happening in the world, again, getting out in our landscapes, enjoying the garden, and engaging these children is something we can all do. And I'm just happy to be part of it.
Yeah, for sure. How do people reach you online?
Yeah, actually, if they Google up Landscape Prescriptions by MD, they'll find me. There is a Landscape Prescriptions arborist in the Minneapolis area, if that's not me, but ultimately... my consultation business has a website with my email and other contact info. And if they have other questions, I love education. I appreciate being on your show as always, but people should reach out and do get out to your local public gardens as they open and support all your local growers. It's a tough year for everyone, but let's get some beautiful plants in our yards.
Yeah, well, Mark, it is always a pleasure to have you with us. And I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
I would love to, Larry. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Mark Dwyer, our guest, former director of horticulture at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. His new business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD, does a lot of speaking and certainly a lot of advising people with their lawns. They want advice. Mark's been doing a lot of it, obviously. So great to have him with us, and we'll have him back. Just look ahead next week on Garden Talk. Melinda Myers will be back to answer your gardening questions. Of course, you can listen at 11 on Fridays, and you can also listen 6 a.m. on Saturdays. Or you know what? Just go online. You can listen anytime. Go to WPR.org/Larry, and there you'll find all of the back programs. Monday, we'll talk about tech issues and answer your tech questions. And of course, that starts at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend, but stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.